following story is copyright 1972 by R.A. Lafferty from the book Strange Doings, apparently printed there for the first time, according to the acknowledgments page. Once on Arania by R.A. Lafferty, read by Goblin Hood. One fine spider silk, no more than 1/80,000th of an inch thick. Could this bind and kill a man? He would soon know. It would be a curious death to be done in by fine spider silk. But then mine has been a curious life, Scarbo muttered from a tight throat, and it might as well have an ironic end to it. I wonder if you know, you mother-loving spiders, he called out with difficulty, that every death is ironic. The arachnidian irony has a pretty fine edge, though. It had begun on Arania a week earlier. In their surveying of the planet-sized asteroids of the Cercyon belt, their practice was, after the team had completed the initial base survey, to leave a lone man on the asteroid for a short period. The theory was that any malevolent force which might not move against a group could come into the open against a lone man. In practice, it had given various results. Donners said that nothing at all had happened on his world when he was there alone, and that nothing had happened to him. But Donners had developed a grotesque facial tic and an oddity of speech and manner. Something had happened to him which he had not realized. Prokop had simply disappeared from his world completely and with no residue. He couldn't have traveled 100 kilometers on foot in the time he had, and there was no reason for him to travel even 10. He should have left traces of the calcium which was hardly on that world at all, of cellular decomposition of amino acids. If a gram of him had been left on that world in any form, the scanners would have found it, but they hadn't. But exploratory parties grow used to such puzzles. Bernheim said that he had gone to pieces when left alone. He did not know whether there had been strange happenings on his world or in his head. He had straightened up only with a great effort when he saw them come back for him, he said. Bernheim had always been a man of compulsive honesty. Marin said that it hadn't been a picnic when he was left alone, but that nothing had happened there that he wouldn't be able to find an answer to if he could devote 1,000 years to it. He said it was more a test of a man than of a world, but it was the test that the party was to use for the livableness of a world. On Arania, it was Scarbo who would remain alone and make the test. On Arania, the spider asteroid, there were two sorts of creatures, at first believed to be three, but two of these first apparent forms were different stages of the same species. There were the small four-legged scudders. There were the two-legged, two-armed, upright, straddling fingerlings. Finally, there were the spiders, actually dodecapods, the largest of them as big as a teacup. The two-legged fingerlings were the spiders after their metamorphosis. Bernheim was reading his report, the final bit for the initial base survey. The basic emotion of the small quadrupeds, Scuderae Bernheimiensis, is subservience. They register that they are owned by the spider complex and that they must serve it. So there are two species, one slave to the other, said Marin. It's a common pattern. The biped fingerlings, larva, Arachnida, Marin, do not realize their relationship to the spiders. Bernheim continued. When forced into the metamorphosis, their reaction is stark consternation. So would mine be, said Scarble. And what's the basic emotion of the adult spiders, the arachne dodecapode Scarble? It is mother love, lately reoriented by an intrusion and intensified many fold. By what intrusion, and how intensified? Marin asked. We are the intrusion, we are the intensification, Bernheim explained. They are intensely excited only since our arrival. That murmuring and chirping of millions of them is all for us. This is material, maternal affection gone hysterical. For us, they exploded in the first real laughter ever heard on Arania, and even the spiders giggled in million-voiced accord. Oh, those mother-loving spiders became their byword for their stay there, and it had to go into the report. So it was with rare good humor that three of them, Bernheim, Marin, Donners, took off and left Scarble alone on the spider world, himself chortling every time he thought of the maternal spiders. For companion, Scarble had only a dog named Dog, which is to say, Sion. It was a classical dog. This would be easy. Scarble liked spiders and even looked like one. A spindly, wiry man covered with black hair almost everywhere, except on the top of his head. A man who ran much to long legs and arms and had not a great amount of body to him. When he waved his arms, as he did when he talked, he gave the impression of having more than two of them. Even his humor was spider-like. And what was there to scare any man in the golden daylight of Arania? Scarble had the name of not being afraid of anything. He had been diligent to give himself that name. And courage is the normal complement of the male animal everywhere. Individual exceptions are common in every species, but they are abnormal. Scarble was normal. And should normal courage fail, they had left him a supply of Dutch courage, and French, Scots, Canadian, and Kentucky, as well as a distilled on the wing drink known as Rocket Red. They always left a man with a good bottled stock. It was on this prime stock that the shadow of the coming thing first fell, and Scarble didn't recognize it. He was delighted when he woke from his first sleep on Arania and saw the stuff as covered with cobwebs as though it had been 100 years in a cellar. He sampled it with exceptional pleasure, mellow. Even the Rocket Red had acquired age and potent dignity. Then he walked all over Arania with the dog Sion. That whole world was covered with golden cobwebs, and it brought out the song in Scarble, Man Afoot. Here was a whole echoing world to sing in. The full voice is also the normal complement of the male animal, and Scarble had a voice, a bad one, that would fill a world. The spaceman frolicked with his girl, though all his friends could not abide her. She was a pippin and a pearl. She was a comely 12-legged spider. Scarble added dozens of verses, most of them obscene, while the spider audience in its millions chirped and murmured appreciation. He sang them to the tune of Ganymede's Saturday Night. He sang all his ballads to that tune. It was the only tune he knew. Marin had been wrong. It was a picnic after all. Scarble sat on the edge of one of the silken, ringed spider ponds and communed with the mother-loving spiders. The cycle of them, he knew, was this. The little biped fingerlings were born in a sort of call. Most often, the call is only wrapped about them, and the young ones fight their way out of it and become aware. Sometimes they look as if they arrived wearing space helmets. Often the young are truly live born, with only scraps on them of the egg they should have arrived in. The spiders have been surprised in their era of transition. The newborn bipeds refuse the care of the adult spiders and run wild at this stage of their being. They destroy everything of the spider nettings and handicrafts that they are able to, and the adult spiders regard them patiently with that abiding mother love. And sometime later, when it is time for the change, the adults drug these young, bind them, weave a silk shell around them, and then put a cap on it. Into the cap, it is the hood of the cocoon, is placed one of the small four-legged scudders, freshly killed and made putrescent in some manner. This is the whole purpose of life in life of the scudders, to feed the pupa form of the spiders. The pupa spider is somnolent for a long time, then it begins to eat of the putrescence in the hood and to change. Four little notches grow out of each of its sides. With these, it saws away the cocoon and emerges as a new being. Soon the notches will grow to full members, and the creature then takes its place as a full adult of the nation of spiders. The spiders were master engineers, and the pattern of the spider ponds built by them covered the world, the whole world of Aranya. They controlled the waters of that world with their silken dams, weirs, levees, and hurdles. The spiders were literal creatures and had to maintain a controllable water level. The lakes and ponds were divided by silken barriers into small plots, some of them so completely covered by blue-green vegetation as to have the appearance of lush meadows, others adjacent to them being clear of all growth. The spiders seeded and they harvested. At some of their major dams, there were anchoring cables as much as an inch in diameter. Scarbo estimated that there might be as many as 7 billion individual spider silks making up such a cable. Scarbo sat on the silken edge of one of the pools while the spiders in their myriads twittered about him. Then an expert crew of them performed certain rites at that pool, sweeping it, making it clearer, inviting him to drink. "Thank you," said Scarbo. He leaned into it and drank deeply. Then he stretched out to rest on the silken shore. He went to sleep. He dreamed that it was snowing, but in a new and pleasant manner. It was not like Earth snow, and not at all like the biting snow of Priestly Planet or the blue horror that is the lethal snow on Arrestor. This was warm snow, light and full of sun. Snowflakes with beards on them like moat-sized comets. Scarbo was being covered over by a warm snow that was half sunshine. He awoke lazily and discovered that it was true. The spiders had been covering him with gossamer and silk, as children on a beach will cover one another with sand. They shot the silks out over him like millions of streamers of serpentine. It was a party, a ball given for him. And the spider song had now reached a point of excitement and jubilation. Scarbo tried to raise his head and found that he could not. He gave it up and lay back, deliciously lazy. This was something new in ease. Whether he was sleeping or waking, it was all the same. A picnic, after all, to be so pleasantly drugged. To be what? An ugly thought came into Scarbo's mind, and he chased it away. It came again and sat like a little black animal on the edge of his golden dream. Why hadn't he been able to raise his head? He cleared his mind of the beginnings of panic. "Here, here," he called out. "You're covering me too deep with that damned sand. Fun's fun, but that's enough." But it was more cohesive than sand. This might be only a noonday dream that would slide away. Well, it wasn't. It was stark afternoon reality. The spiders had him pegged down to the ground with their billion-stranded silk bonds, and he could barely move a muscle. and the mother-loving little abominations had drugged him by whatever they had put into the inviting drinking pool. The taste in his mouth reminded him of the knockout drops they used to pass out free as water on New Shanghai. The spider song became more complex. There were elements of great change in it, the motifs of one world falling away and another one being born. The golden daylight of Urania was coming to an end. Scarbo had enjoyed his luxurious drugged sleep for more hours than he had believed. Completely weary of his struggle with his bonds, he dropped to sleep again, and the spiders continued to work through the night. The first thing that Scarbo saw in the morning, out of the corner of one eye, fixed in his unmoving head, was the spiders maneuvering a large golden ball toward him. They tipped it with lines from the tops of gin poles. They rolled it over and over, reset their rigging, and rolled it again. It was the dog, Sian, dead and cocooned in a sack of silk. The stench of it was unbearable. The dog was not only dead, but decayed, almost liquid in its putrefaction, and with the high hair still on it. Scarbo was sickened by this, but he understood the nature of the happening. He was a naturalist, and he knew that anger was an unnaturalist response, and that murder and putrefaction are natural workings. But Sian wasn't merely a dog. He was also a personal friend of Scarbo. Scarbo could not turn to see what was behind his own head, but he knew that spiders had been working on something there all night. He realized now what it was, a snood, a capuchin, like a friar's, the hood to be his new cocoon. He knew with horror what thing they were rolling into that hood now, and how the hood would be joined onto his own cocoon. It happened quickly. Scarbo's screams were drowned in the near-liquid mass. They had a drum-like sound even to his own ears, as though they were coming from underwater. They merged easily with the spider music, which had just the place for that screaming motif. Then overpowering sickness sent Scarbo into merciful unconsciousness after the dead and rotting dog was rolled into his face and closed in with him, as their cocoon became one. How long does it take a man to die in such circumstances? Scarbo set his mind to do it as quickly as possible, but he was too tough for his own good. By second night, he still could not arrive at death, but he welcomed the dark. The dog's carcass had become higher and more pungent, and the agony of Scarbo took on new refinements. He was thirsty to the point of madness, and so hungry that he could eat anything, almost anything. It frightened him that he could now understand the spider mind so clearly. The spiders worked by analogy. They believed Scarbo to be an unfinished, two-legged strider, come to them with his quadruped that was born for one purpose, to feed him when he went into pupa form, before being metamorphosed into a giant emperor spider. Aye, they believed Scarbo to be the emperor spider promised to them from the beginning of time. The spider song was a dirge now, the passing of the old life, the death and decay fugue. But in the complex of the dirge, there were introductory passages of something much higher, the anastasis, the resurrection song. "You mother-loving spiders," Scarbo called out in fury. "You think I'm going to eat Sian and then turn into a spider? You're wrong, I tell you. The biology of the thing is impossible. But how do you explain biology to spiders? To be dying of thirst, and there no liquid to mouth except that. To be starving, and there no food available but this soft putridity pressed into his face." There was a change in the tempo of the spider song. It rose in the crescendo of transition and made Scarbo angry. "You presumptive presumptive little 12-legged crawlers are getting ahead of me. Don't tell me what to do. Don't act as though I had already done it. But the hours had taken their prize, and Scarble had already passed through madness and into the world on the other side. He didn't know when it began, but the spiders knew of the change about third dawn. The spider's soaring incantation rose to new heights, and Scarble was able to follow it. He was hearing tones above the range of the human ear. Scarble began to eat of the putrefied mass and to change. The hallelujah chorus of the spider song rose in a vast symphony. In the spaceman's survival handbook, there is one instruction which some have believed to be written in humor. Never die till you have considered every alternative to a situation. Well, how does a man get out of a situation like this? He doesn't. Well, then how does a spider get out of a situation like this? He grows 8 more short little notches of legs, and he shuffles and saws his way out of the cocoon with them. It's worth a try, Scarble said. I'll see if I've turned into a spider. He had. He did it. It worked. They disabilitated Scarble from the active service. He could give no intelligent account of his lone stay on Arania. He gave out with nothing but sick quips like, Sian was a good dog, but only after he had become very bad. And the spiders tied me up and made me eat the dog, and then they turned me into a spider. Scarble was plainly insane, but pleasantly so, and there was nothing left of the dog except curiously softened bones. They sent Scarble back to Earth and kept him under observation. Such men were handled with sympathy. They called him the Spider-Man around the wards, but after a while that sympathy ran a little thin. Earth was having her own troubles with spiders. I've never seen anything like them, an Earthside doctor told Scarbo in examining him one day as he brushed some of that floating stuff out of his eyes. The growths are not malignant, but they will be mighty unhandy. Since they are not malignant, I cannot remove them without your permission, Scarble. They're getting larger, you know. Certainly they're getting larger, Scarble maintained. I'm quite pleased with the way they're coming along. They get to be as big as the spider's other legs. And don't remove them. I'd as soon lose one of my other limbs as one of them. They saved my life. I wouldn't have gotten out of my cocoon without them. You're going to have to get off this spider jag, Scarble. Have you been reading the crank reports about the spiders, and have they upset you? Why should they upset me, Doctor? Everything is going as smooth as, spider silk. Naturally, I have my own intelligence set up on these matters, and the fact that you refer to them as crank reports likewise pleases me. I'm on top of the heap, Doctor. Who else has 100 billion soldiers ready to strike? We live in exciting times, do we not? As to that sickness of yours, Scarble, I'll gladly leave it to your other doctor, your psycho doctor. And now it is time for you to go and see him. But I wish you'd let me remove those growths before they become larger. They're almost like other limbs. Quite like, said Scarble. He left the room majestically in the flowing robes which he now affected and went down the corridor to see his other doctor. The robes served a purpose. They did cover Scarble's afflictions, the 4 strange growths on each side of his body, and also... An emperor always wears flowing robes, Scarble said. You can't expect him to go dressed like a commoner. Dr. Mosca, Scarble's other doctor, was a quiet and patient man. He was also a dull fellow who had to have simple things explained to him over and over again. Where are you today, Scarble? Dr. Mosca asked again as he brushed some of the floating stuff away. Why, I'm the emperor of the dodecapod spiders of Urania, Scarble said pleasantly. I explain that to you every day, Doctor, but you don't seem to remember. I am also prefect extraordinary to the Urania spiders of the dispersal, and I am proconsul to the spiders of Earth. Scarble, I'll be plain with you. Your planet probe experience, whatever it was, has unhitched your mind, and you have somehow connected whatever happened on Urania to the recent spider incidents on Earth. I will admit that some of these incidents are peculiar and almost insane.
No, no, Doctor, not insane. They are absolutely reasonable. According to the higher reason, they are organized and directed and strictly on schedule. To call the incidents insane would be almost like calling me insane.
Mr. Scarble, we don't keep you here for your pool shooting ability, though you're good at that. We keep you here because you're very sick, mentally. Now listen to me carefully. You are a man and not a spider.
I'm glad you think so, Doctor. Our High Council decided that it would be better if I retained the basic man appearance until our present military operation is completed. It should be completed today.
Scarble, you've got to get hold of yourself,
Dr. Mosca insisted. He brushed heaps of the accumulated silk stuff off his desk.
You are a man, and an intelligent man. We have to get you off this insane spider jag of yours. And it's not my department, but somebody had better get the world off its jag, too. Every year has its own peculiar sort of nuttiness, but the spider incidents have become downright silly. Do you know that with the recent astronomical increases of the spiders?
That may be an unconscious pun, Scarble interrupted.
That it is estimated there are now 100 billion spiders in this country alone.
Multiply that figure by 1,000 if you wish, Scarble said. Last night was the night of the great hatching, and the young ones grow to effective size in hours, all stages of them quickly now. The time is at hand. I give the word now.
Great thumping thunder, Dr. Mosca howled. I'm bitten badly. Another spider bite.
Not just another bite, Scarble said. That was the critical bite. I'm sincerely sorry for the pain, but with so many people to impregnate, I could not equip all of my creatures with painless probes. It eases off now, though, doesn't it? The injection contains a narcotic and a soporific.
It did. Dr. Mosca drowsed. He half dreamed that it was snowing, but in a new and pleasant manner. It was warm snow, light and full of sun, flakes with beards on them like moat-sized comets. The suddenly appearing spiders were covering Dr. Mosca with gossamer and silk, as children will cover each other with sand on a beach. And they were covering many millions of others, all stung and sunk into pleasant lethargy and drowsiness, with billions of streamers of serpentine silk. It was deliciously lazy for Dr. Mosca to lie back in the chair and hear that demented Scarble drone on that he was no longer a man. Dr. Mosca found that he could no longer move his head. There was something odd about that. That Scarble was no longer a man, whatever his appearance, that he was really the emperor of the dodecapod spiders of Urania, and of all spiders everywhere.
The following piece was copyright 1952 by Halton Press, London, for Mystery, which was evidently a small collection of stories, possibly all by Algernon Blackwood. Along Came a Spider by Algernon Blackwood, read by Goblin Hood. I share our lovely planet with another inhabitant who inspires me with a degree of loathing that includes fear, even horror. If brought suddenly face to face with this repulsive individual, something akin to paralysis attacks my muscular system, so that for a passing moment, I seem unable to act. I stand and stare, fascinated, frightened, and without knowing why. You have guessed, of course. I'm talking of my private personal phobia, a spider. Now, phobias are common, especially this one of spiders, and a phobia is a secret fear for which no explanation occurs. The prenatal theory is discarded. Autosuggestion does not work. It is a groundless yet persistent fear, innate in the blood. It appears often in the most fantastic forms. But while you can laugh at the fluttering moths that terrify some people, you never can laugh at your own. Spiders, for instance, are not ludicrous to myself. I dislike their nasty, hairy legs, their too greedy, swollen abdomens, their vile way of eating their bound and helpless prey, or, when bigger, snatching tiny birds from the nest before they can fly. Their eight eyes, too, are sinister, since you cannot know what they are really looking at, nor what kind of portrait they see. Horrible, too, is the way the female devours her husband even before she has divorced him. All these, however, are surface blemishes. There is something much deeper than all that, if I could only get at it. Does a big spider, for instance, radiate something inimical in the way some folks think a cat announces its near presence long before it is seen? The mere idea is comic, yet if I see a big spider on the ceiling of my bedroom, say on a country visit, I cannot go to sleep until I have persuaded the monster to leave. Naturally, friends declare a fright in childhood, in early childhood, explains my phobia, though it is wholly untrue, yet I recall a recurrent nightmare in childhood and youth that haunted me, but it was an after effect rather than a cause. In my dream, I first heard something creeping cautiously across the carpet toward my bed. On reaching the sheets, it began to climb steadily. With its fantastic eyes, it picked out available hand or footholds. Once on the counterpane, I could hear its many scrabbling feet as it crawled along the edge of the sheets and blankets where these lay against my cheeks. And then it paused, seeing me, no doubt, from fantastic angles with its horrible, queer eyes. A feathery touch brushed my skin. I woke, or thought I woke, in the nightmare. And there, staring at me, perched a big, dark spider. The nightmare broke. I shot out of bed. No sign of a spider anywhere. Had it been a fly, a beetle, a caterpillar, I would not have cared tuppence. The horror of the nightmare clung for some minutes. But anyhow, this nightmare was not the cause of my phobia. I've often asked myself why this beast is so repulsive and frightening to people like myself with a form of spider phobia. But asking questions has not cured me. Spiders often have lovely coloring. Also, they have no teeth to bite you with, and very few carry poison glands. Their legs may be unpleasant to look at, I know, yet those legs are provided with an ingenious contrivance that constructs faultlessly the geometrical wonder of their web. With the morning dew sparkling on that taut, elastic structure, few sights are more lovely. The tiny kind that adventure gaily for great distances on barely visible strips of gossamer contribute an authentic touch of fairyland. Yet, yes, I stand with hat off in admiration and respect to their amazing skill and ingenuity, from the trapdoor spider onwards. Thus, I have tried to see both sides of the horror, as it were. My hate is not just blind hate. Moreover, spiders possess yet another distinction I am sure they are proud of. They are not insects. They have eight legs, not six. They have their own family name, which they share with scorpions, arachnidae. So there it is. The more I study them, the less can I understand why this acute form of phobia can remain in my blood all these years of my long life. Nor has any doctor I have asked given me any clue. I recall an unpleasant incident with a tarantula once in Toronto, where long ago I shared a ground floor in a boarding house with another English boy. Folding doors divided us. One afternoon he greeted me with an expression of rapture. "Oh, I say, what do you think I've got?" With immense pride, he opened a small box he held. I saw inside a full-size, hairy-legged tarantula, big as a mouse. He had bought a bunch of bananas from some southern state. The tarantula was a stowaway. I watched him stroke the devil, yes, actually stroke it. I saw the pride and happiness in his eyes. He was 17, I was over 18. I concealed my ludicrous phobia. He could not detect my icy shudder. I begged him to be careful. "It's dangerously poisonous," I remarked, "but won't attack unless frightened." Oh yes, he knew all that. I went out while he kept repeating, "Isn't it a beauty?" An hour or two later, I came into bed. He greeted me. "Oh, I say, it's escaped." It had. A search of the two dingy rooms with so many dark corners was a waste of time. I went to bed. When I opened my eyes in the morning, I saw the monster stuck to the wall facing me across the small bedroom. It was close to a hot air pipe in the wall. Adrenaline poured into my blood, but I knew enough not to attack. If left alone, it would merely watch me out of its fantastic eyes, all its horrid legs ready to leap, but otherwise quiet. I wriggled out of bed and crawled inch by inch, covered by sheets and blankets, lest even a toe might stick out, and reached the door. At the door, however, I was compelled to stretch out an uncovered arm to turn the handle. Once safely in the passage, I turned. The monster, of course, hadn't moved. My young friend later picked it off with his ungloved fingers. It is not always easy to establish what is or is not a genuine phobia, but at any rate, the obvious fears, tigers, poisonous snakes, fire, common to all of us, conceal no secret cause. Is, for instance, a bat in the phobia class? Some people I have asked say at once, "Oh yes, bats, of course, I'm terrified of bats." A bat, we know, may specially alarm women if it darts by chance through an open window into the room, but that is no mystery. It is perhaps because they fear it may get entangled in their long hair. The wonderful radar wings, of course, make such a disaster extremely unlikely, for every object in the room sends its message instantly, and the bat immediately avoids striking it. The long hair is quite safe. If the lights are turned out, since bright light distresses it, the bat will dart out again into the dusk in a moment or two. They are mysterious creatures nonetheless, possessed of very unusual powers. The large blood-sucking vampires, for instance. These have been carefully studied in Bolivia, where their feeding habits do great harm to cattle in the fields at night. And this particular group of scientists established that a vampire would never touch a human being before he was genuinely asleep, and no pretense of being asleep could ever deceive them. The white men under their blankets might snore, lie motionless, breathe deeply, and assume all the posture of profound slumber, but no bat would come near them. Sooner or later, of course, they would slip off into genuine slumber, and in flitted the bat noiselessly, having spotted a toe or finger not under cover, and next morning they would have lost a quantity of blood. Moreover, this creature's very sharp incisor teeth have been thoughtfully equipped by nature with a minute gland of some kind that injects a drop of some soothing mixture so that the pain of the prick is not even felt. The man slumbers on undisturbed. Anyhow, I don't think either bats or cats can be regarded as genuine phobias that exercise their strange gifts on us by way of foolish and quite unnecessary terrors. I remember reading of a remarkable case of a woman's acute spider phobia. Apparently, she knew a big spider was in her room before she saw it. I read this in a medical journal of repute, though without editorial sanction. It was either an article or a letter. Her own spider phobia was too acute to be laughed away. Her temperature went up. There were genuine hysterics. Even the heart was infected. Her husband, who treated these outbursts with sympathy and understanding, heard her scream for help one afternoon and dashed up to her bedroom, where she had gone to rest. "A big spider in the room," she cried. "I haven't seen it. For goodness sake, get it out." She was in acute distress. He searched in vain, soothing her as best he could. Presently, his brother joined in the search, and later, his eye picked out a large garden spider lying motionless among the toilet articles on the dressing table, cleverly camouflaged by chance. Without saying a word, he quietly squashed it. The woman on the sofa at the end of the room could not possibly have seen this, but instantly cried out in a voice of intense relief, "Oh, it's gone!" And she soon recovered her equanimity. Now I know that many haters of cats claim to know if there is one about long before they see it. I cannot say. The cat, an electrical beastie, but a great friend of mine, a great pal of mine, may conceivably radiate a warning message, but I find it hard to believe a spider has any gift of that sort. But who knows? I certainly do not. An odd incident comes to my mind where a woman with a real spider phobia, though not acute, paid a morning visit to her garden in the sunshine and chatted with her gardener. A huge garden spider sat in the center of its beautiful web. She made some unkind remark about spiders to the gardener. "They're not bad to eat, you know, madam," he observed as he picked it out of the web, gave a quick chew, and swallowed it. "A bit on the sweet side, I always think," he added, selecting another one, even fatter and juicier. The following story is from The Miner's Pale Children, New York, Athenaeum Publishers, 1970. Copyright by W.S. Merwin. Spiders I Have Known by W.S. Merwin, read by Goblin Hood. The one no bigger than the head of a pencil that emerged from the forehead of the new dentist, perhaps an inch above his left eyebrow, ran down to the eyebrow and along it, and dropped from the side of his face to the little scalloped glass tray on which the dentist was selecting a drill. It then disappeared, from my sight at least. I did not wish to call the dentist's attention to it at that precise moment. Besides, I recognized that it was a perfectly harmless variety. I would have been ashamed to be afraid. The one that I found had taken up residence in a bundle of letters only a few months old. It was smaller than the wolf spiders that live in some of the corners and do no harm at all. It was also darker than they and heavily, beautifully furred. Some of its children clung to it like troops of tiny dust-colored anthropoids, and others had taken up lodgings in several of the larger envelopes. I looked up the species. Its bite is not poisonous, if I identified it correctly. I devoted some time to trying to remember which letters those were, who had written them, what they had said, whether I had answered them, and how things now stood as a result with each of the correspondents. I would have been afraid to be ashamed. The one that hung in the old apple tree that spring when we returned at last to the farm by the lake with its old garden into which I had been allowed to run, with only a perfunctory word of caution from my mother, a word whose real purpose had been to dispel the attention of my father. The blossoms were just opening, on the tree and the air rushed past me, carrying them with it as though I were on a swing, when suddenly there it was in front of me, as big as my face against the bright sky, the color and depth of the fenders of the new car. The whole web was swaying gently in the wind. The abdomen had a kind of face on it. No, not a face, a mask, in orange and yellow. I knew it was a kind that was more afraid of me than I was of it. I was ashamed. The one that ran across each of my footprints in turn as I was crossing the dry bin on my way back when you were sick and we didn't know how it would go after that, but maybe it wasn't working at all. I had the medicines, but not much faith in them. It came to the edge of each footprint, hesitated, and then shot across like a woman with a baby, afraid of snipers, or a good child caught in a cloudburst. I couldn't understand how it kept up with me. My hands were full. You were in pain. I didn't want to stop. It's bad luck to harm them, poor things. Besides, the danger of that species has been greatly exaggerated. I would have been ashamed. From Beatty's Americana, Volume 1, Number 4, Copyright 1990, by James Beatty. Read by Goblin. Note, I'm going to postpone the Americana stuff until after this next story, since I'm beginning the tape with it. This only deals peripherally with spiders, but they get more and more peripheral as we go on. Somehow it's been difficult to find stories about spiders to put on here. So the first side of the tape is probably the most successful in that regard. Anyway, this is probably the most concise treatment of this, of what I like to call the Spider Day horror, although it shows up in various other places, most notably perhaps the novel Goblinhood Satyricon. Anyway, this is from the book Nightmares for the Yesterday People and Other Illustrated Stories, copyright 1981 by James Beatty, and it's called The Eros Tree, read by Goblinhood. Introduction. Police state your name, rank, and sexual preference. Animal, vegetable, mineral, other. The following story is not about drugs, but it does have its roots in the so-called drug culture, which helped to characterize the so-called cultural revolution of the 60s. You might say that the story grew from seeds which I planted during the late summer of 69. I, of course, was a lot younger back then, and I was also a great deal more reckless and self-destructive than I am today. In many ways, my life seems to have meant almost nothing to me at the time. Bored and alienated, and living in a small town that was literally steeped in the repressive atmosphere of America during the Vietnam War, I was finally driven to experiment with mind-altering substances. Sadly, my experiments, which were born of a kind of desperation, led to even more desperate and ultimately disastrous results. In August of 1969, I became the victim of a hellish concoction, which I've nicknamed Spider Day, in honor of its more basic aspects and principal effects. This homemade hallucinogenic potion, more powerful than LSD, was derived from ingredients both legal and easily available. It produces a condition which is not unlike delirium tremens. As a foulness shall ye know them,
wrote H.P. Lovecraft, author of The Dunwich Horror and principal creator of the eerie Cthulhu mythos. And his invisible alien demons and elder gods were certainly no more horrible than the frenzied revelations that I beheld under the influence of Spider Day, an experience very similar to what Philip K. Dick was describing in the beginning of his drug novel, A Scanner Darkly. In a deranged state of toxic psychosis, I was driven from my house by ghastly hallucinations and phobic visions of spiders and insects, and even more horrid and loathsome creatures crawling all over me and all over everything in sight. I wound up raving and gibbering in the front yard, or perhaps it was a neighbor's yard. But wherever I was, there was a tree there, at least in my own mind. And as I sat there or stood there or sprawled there under its boughs, terribly alone, but surrounded by imaginary spiders and Martians in the grass, talking to it or embracing it or whatever I thought I was doing with it there in the queasy sunlight of a strange and sinister alien morning, the tree gave me comfort and sanctuary of a sort and became my very best friend for a while. At least until the police showed up and dragged me away from my leafy green companion, hustling me hence to the hellish hallucinogenic halls of Torquemada, where I was put to the question and treated to the single most horrible and traumatizing series of experiences in my life so far. The rest of this grisly event doesn't really concern us here. In any case, I've already written about it at great length in a story entitled Spider Day, which I hope to publish soon. But the following events, which took place almost a decade after the Spider Day horror, can easily be looked upon as a direct sequel to my experience with that quite possibly imaginary tree. A happy reunion with what I must regard as a quasi-mythical being, perhaps a dryad left over from the childhood of our sad and once green planet. These regal creatures are old and wise, and were here long before you and I, and will, I pray, still be here after you and I are long gone. For though I am as wasteful as the next American, and though I too have participated in the mindless destruction and great rape of the trees as we continue to wrap garbage burgers with them and blow our noses into them and smoke cigarettes made from them and wipe our asses all over them and even print stories like the following on their pitiful ravaged corpses. Yet I, fool that I am, must still call them my friends. The Eros Tree. The following is a true story. Word of honor, it really happened. I was on my way home late one bright, sunny afternoon, and I believe that I had just been to the grocery store. I don't remember exactly what I'd been doing, but the store sounds like a safe enough bet. Anyway, it was a beautiful day out, and I was paying a much greater attention than usual to my natural surroundings. In fact, when I got home, I couldn't help noticing, with a good deal of unprecedented and inexplicable enchantment, the tree that stands in front of my house. As I gazed at this leafy creature through the golden green haze of sunshine, it dawned upon me that I had never truly looked at this tree before. It was beautiful, tall and stately and graceful, rough, textured, and yet warmly inviting to the touch. The tree seemed like an old friend or a lost but long familiar lover. Indeed, my heart somehow went completely out to this tree as I touched it and felt it respond to my caress. And underneath the sway of aesthetic appreciation for the tree's beauty and glorious majesty,
underneath the singular and wholly unexpected lure of the strange and overwhelming sense of communion and oneness that I was experiencing with this tree, I have to admit that there was also a fiercely erotic pulse of sexual arousal stirring within the very pits of my soul. And the tree was aware of this. I could sense its acknowledgement and its own heated lust, and I could feel it quivering through its horny bark, ravenous and wrapped and aching with desire. And then I noticed something truly incredible about the tree. Scrutinizing it closely for the first time, I realized that, though it had no other humanoid aspects and was without even a discernible gender, the tree did have an ass. And what an ass. It was the single most luscious and glorious ass that I've ever seen, all golden and soft, where the rest of the tree was coarse and hard. An ass that the gods themselves might well have lusted after. And as I gaped, agape, and drooling pruriently with near godlike lust, I saw that the tree's ass was squirming and twitching, writhing in ecstatic, frenzied yearning, and suddenly I knew, without any trace of a doubt, that the tree also wanted what I now desperately wanted, what I wanted more than anything else in the world. And before I quite knew what was happening, I was making wild and passionate love to the tree, panting and moaning, naked, in the golden splendor of the late afternoon. I don't know what happened to my clothes. And I also don't know just what I could have been thinking to so thrust aside convention and thus madly flaunt the weird sexual taboos of our society right under the very eyes and noses of all my straight-laced Victorian village neighbors. Consumed by a rabid, burning need to sodomize around with this friendly tree, I truthfully didn't care what the neighbors thought, although I knew that they were probably calling the police. And sure enough, as I was furiously bucking and humping in my mad flight to orgasmic fulfillment, I noticed a throbbing red pulsation of light flashing subtly across the trees surrounding green filigree. And I looked up and my heart fell to my feet, and I was frozen for a moment with sheer and unutterable horror as I beheld a police squad car squatting in my driveway, revving up its engine. And I thought, this is it. I've been caught red-handed in the single craziest act of my life. A life that would now be finished up behind bars, no doubt, if the police didn't simply shoot me out of hand. But what the devil were they doing? A black policewoman and a white male officer were sitting in the squad car, and I was publicly fucking a tree in broad daylight. But they were just sitting there, flashing their lights and revving up their engine, and then I recognized the sound of that engine, and I knew in an instant that I was safe. I wasn't really out in the front yard. I was actually lying safely in bed in the late afternoon, and that wasn't the police at all. It was the man who lived downstairs out revving the engine of his car in the driveway of our house. That's right. I was dreaming, which I should have realized long before this. And even if the cops could see what I was doing, they couldn't really do anything about it. They probably couldn't even get out of their car. They were probably only there from the car's windows on up, with nothing below that, not even a gun. They were virtually powerless to stop me from screwing this tree, because it was my dream. And so the dream police had to just sit there, in the throbbing green haze of the summer wind, flashing their little red lights and revving up their big bad engine, and just watching me, laughing maniacally at them as the greatest dream of my life rushed headlong to its inevitable climax.
And unless I want to, well, this is Goblin again. Unless I want to just incorporate fragments of stories, I don't have room for anything else involving spiders. I could have done Liber's Bazaar of the Bazaar, but I have to do it on a different tape because it's too long for one side of this. So I'm going to round this out with some stories from Beatty's Americana, only the first one of which has anything at all to do with spiders. Interestingly, you note by the dates, these were all from some journal in 1988. They're all dream stories. And the first two were on the same day. They were the latest of the bunch. The second one was the earliest of the bunch, almost 2.5 months before. And the third one, I mean, and the fourth one is like, you know, right in the middle, and was one of my weird Thanksgiving dreams. Apparently. Actually, no, the third one is the next year. So, I mean, this stuff covers a wide range. It's all from Beatty's Americana, Volume 1, Number 4. Thursday, 12/15/88. Commercial festivities, public dining, and a proposed shopping spree. Editor's note. I suppose the following two dreams were my way of participating in the holiday spirit. 5 p.m. A matter of face. I dreamed I was in a crowded restaurant or a cafeteria, so I guess I was dining out for a change. I wound up having to kill a giant spider with a sword. The spider was a black and yellow garden spider as big as me. I claimed boastfully that this was Shelob, the spider battled by Frodo in J.R.R. Tolkien's Return of the King. The sword was a slightly sharper version of my father's old army saber. It did the job. At the end, I was a big hero. A friend advised me to settle down with this woman who was standing by, watching. She loved me, he said, but her face had been sliced off. 11 p.m. Zim Zam shopping. I was celebrating Christmas with the Zen Brotherhood, one of whom had a Great Dane. The Zen mother was there too, but she was dead, the skeleton at the feast, as it were. Our first order of business was to dispose of the corpse. I had to cut off one of her hands, apparently to fit her into this plastic body bag we had. Then a young brother and I went out, snuck into a nearby cemetery with the bag, and furtively buried the Zen mother. This all seemed perfectly normal at the time. Upon my return, I noticed the Great Dane trying to eat the hand which I'd forgotten and left on the kitchen floor. I ushered the dog out and began planning to get rid of the hand. While I pondered the matter, I began cooking a hamburger, amazed at the notion that I might actually be able to eat now. The Red Muse came into the kitchen. While I was munching my burgers, she began cooking steaks for her and her friends. I told her that I was going to have to leave for a while. I also mentioned the hand in a corny, creepy, Count Floyd type of voice, and we both laughed. She seemed unperturbed by the situation, but told me to make sure one of those blue-coated devils didn't catch me with the hand. I guess she must have meant the police. In my mind, I was already tossing this grisly relic into a nearby river. Then as I picked up the hand and prepared to leave, the Red Muse said this, don't do any zimzam shopping between battles while you're over there in Vietnam or Korea. I was really rocked. I'm not going off to war, I said. Whatever made you think I was? She drew back, looking confused and uneasy. I thought of trying to tell her that I was probably sick enough to die soon anyway. But whatever dream logic there was fell away and I woke up in pain. Editor's note. The above dreams took place shortly after Viotti had become afflicted with a mild but painful stomach ulcer and was unable for a while to eat anything, hence the references to food. Tuesday, 8:30, 88, 10:23 a.m., New Year's Eve. Warning, the following story is not approved by the Comics Code Authority. Nobody under the age of 18 should read about this dream unless accompanied by their parents. Thank you. I was living or visiting in some really gigantic metropolis. The weather was extremely mild for New Year's Eve, so I guess this city must have been located somewhere in the south. I was staying with a man and a woman. They were a couple. My relation to either of them remains a mystery, but it wasn't the kind where you could be casual about nudity or bodily functions. This I know, because I had to urinate so urgently that my jaws were aching, and the woman was in the bathroom taking a bath. I didn't want to piss in a jar or something, so I went out looking for a place to take a leak. The apartment building was in a section of the city's downtown business district. It reminded me of an area near Goodale and High Street in Columbus, but it was much bigger. Nearby was an overpass bridge spanning a mammoth 20 or 30 lane superhighway. Again, this resembled I-670, if expanded to near infinity. I went down a long stairway to the banks along the roadway under the bridge. To my vast amazement, I saw the ruins of an entire civilization down there among the grassy hills, silent and oblivious to the myriad cars whizzing by. My bladder forgotten, I stood gaping about me. There were rivers, forests, and mountains along the roadside, as well as crumbled skyscrapers. Droves of people were out for an early evening stroll. Most seemed, like me, to be visitors from above, though I imagined an entire homeless culture of troglodytic lurkers among the shards and rubble. I noticed that many of the wandering crowd appeared to be lovers seeking some quiet spot for sex. Apart from the highway, this weird retreat boasted one other link to the real city. A line of payphones stood nearby. I called my housemates to say that I'd be back in a while. Mingling, I soon fell in with a party of three, two young women and a man. The woman who was with the man seemed intrigued by me, especially after her boyfriend took off with some other woman who wandered by. The two ladies that I was left with introduced themselves as Jane and June. June was the one who'd been sizing me up. Jane began frying some bacon and eggs on an abandoned hibachi, and they both invited me to supper or to a late breakfast in the ruins. While the food cooked, June began exploring in my knapsack. Amid the other clutter, she discovered a copy of my old book, Nightmares for the Yesterday People. Fascinated, she sat down with me on some grassy, overgrown stone steps, evidently part of an ancient temple. There we sprawled amid the orchids and scorpions, slowly leafing through my book, reading it backwards. Eventually, we came to the weirdest story in there, the Eros Tree. In this story, the narrator performs an act of consensual sodomy with a humanoid tree. My companion was staring at the illustration, obviously becoming aroused. She told me that she wanted us to make that kind of love, forgetting about our prospective meal. We embraced passionately and kissed deeply. All around us, people were drinking, snorting stuff, passing joints, and screwing in the grass. In an ecstasy of rapture, I fondled my lover's sweet ass. anticipating how it would look, how it would taste, how it would feel to be buried inside of her, charging towards some great and almost holy orgasm. I could almost sense the promised land under my feet. The surrounding orgy intensified, reaching frenzied new heights of revelry and bacchanalia. June was panting and moaning like a wild animal, tearing at the zipper of my pants with total abandon. Just as she was about to blow me, a harsh voice snarled,
"What the hell do you think you're doing here?"
I looked up in shock. Gosh darn it all, I knew something like this would happen. It was the cops, the fucking dream police again. Who else? The party was over. As pandemonium broke loose, I became only one of what seemed like a million people fleeing from the law. There weren't nearly enough cops to handle it. People were running in every direction, mostly naked. It was like a scene from Thorne Smith's Satyricon. June was long gone, and I was hiding behind some broken wreckage, trying to figure out if I had anything too incriminating in my pockets. Nearby, a cop pulled his gun on Jane, but suddenly dropped it and took off after somebody else. I saw Jane bend to grab the gun, think better of it, and run. Run, Jane, run, I thought, getting up with a swollen erection still sticking out of my pants. I turned to follow a bunch of other horny celebrants up the stairs to the waiting, watching city. I was almost home free when I woke up. This is an editor's note. Thursday, November 23rd, 1989. Thanksgiving morning. The bundle, or travel arrangements, dedicated to Franz Kafka. Editor's note. As is becoming customary for me during this festive time of year, I just suffered my first screamer of the season. That is a weird Kafka-esque nightmare, bad enough to make me wake up moaning and wailing out loud, and to prevent me from sleeping again. The bundle, or travel arrangements. It was a simple life. I lived in a small clapboard and cinder block house with my two sisters, one of whom, Greta, was a woman my own age. The other sister, Joy, was a small girl. As our father was gone, or at least perpetually away, it fell to me to protect my beloved siblings. One day the stranger came like a wolf at the door. He stood on the threshold with a cruel and insinuating smile, claiming to know our father, lustfully eyeing Greta. This unseemly conduct continued and became worse. He invited himself in as an old friend of the family and began advancing on Greta, causing her to retreat backward about the rooms. He was sexually propositioning her in a low, passionate voice of terrible intensity. She was gasping in shock. Joy was hysterically threatening him in a thin, piping voice. I was blustering manfully, loudly exclaiming things like, "See here," and "You can't come in here like this," and "This won't do, you know," but all to no avail. Eventually, the cad seized Greta's wrist as she shrieked in loathing and terror. I saw that further steps would have to be taken. I plucked up a small and rather dull kitchen knife with a serrated edge. "Sir," I cried, "as you are clearly not a gentleman, I must defend my sister. Why, I don't believe you're even a friend of our father." "Your father," he ejaculated with a mad laugh. I began sawing at his neck, trying to hit the jugular vein, but I soon saw that it was no good. The dull knife, after several minutes, had barely worked its way through the first layer of skin. Oddly, my victim submitted quietly to this experiment, laughing viciously all the while.
"You'll never go through with this," he jeered.
As the point of the knife was a bit sharper, I decided to try using that. I had more success this time. I pricked the man in the front of his throat, just under the chin. A drop of blood bubbled forth immediately.
Unfortunately, since even the point of the knife was very dull, the fellow's blood was rather slow in coming out. I finally squeezed his neck as you would a boil or a pimple, and a thin, sluggish squirt of blood oozed out of the hole in a gelid, almost solid stream about 3 inches long. I noticed with satisfaction that our now silent visitor's smirk had been replaced by a shocked, apprehensive look. "And now we must dispose of the body," I exclaimed decisively, feeling like the man of the house. Wide-eyed, Greta preferred a large transparent clothing bag made of very tough plastic. My younger sister watched in feverish excitement, cheering feebly as we stuffed the unwelcome guest into this receptacle like stuffing a Thanksgiving turkey.
"You'll have to carry him off somewhere," said Greta thoughtfully.
"Yes, before Father gets home,"
added Joy with a slight shudder.
"What? But I'm not yet dead,"
argued the presumptive corpse from his bag.
"That's true enough now, but we'll soon change," I shouted angrily, slamming the bag against a clapboard wall, hoping to brain its occupant into death and silence.
It quickly became clear that I'd have to use the stronger outer wall of cinder block for this purpose. We all progressed to the garage with poor little Joy wailing,
"Quickly, before Father gets home!"
With one hand, I slammed the large bundle against the wall repeatedly, hoping to somehow sense the quenching of that spark, which we call life. The creature was harder to kill than a possum. Still, it had to be done. He began to complain loudly.
"That hurts," he cried. And, "What about your father?"
And even,
"This is taking too long."
"Quiet," I growled. "You made these travel arrangements for yourself."
"Travel?"
bellowed the bundle in an outraged voice.
"Travel?"
it roared again, even louder. Suddenly I felt a sharp, grating pain scrape over the knuckles of my bundle-holding hand. It felt uncomfortably like teeth. I looked closely, but the bundle's mouth was nowhere in evidence. That's when I began to scream. Goblinhood again, we seem to have left the concept of spiders way behind. I'm going to finish this up with an excerpt from the great novel by Richard Matheson, The Shrinking Man, copyright 1962 by Richard Matheson. This is from chapter 2. Actually, that's copyright 1956 and then 1962. This is from chapter 2. The spider rushed at him across the shadowed sands, scrabbling wildly on its stalk-like legs. Its body was a giant glossy egg that trembled blackly as it charged across the windless mounds, its wake a score of sand-trickling patch scratches. Paralysis locked the man. He saw the poisonous glitter of the spider eyes. He watched it scramble across a log-like stick, body mounted high on its motion-blurred legs, as high as the man's shoulders. Behind him, suddenly, the steel-encased flame jarred into life with a thunder that shook the air. It jarred the man loose. With a sucking gasp, he spun around and ran, the damp sand crunching beneath his racing sandals. He fled through lakes of light and into darkness again, his face a mask of terror. Beams of sunlight speared across his panic-driven path. Cold shadows enveloped it. Behind, the giant spider scoured sand in his pursuit. Suddenly, the man slipped, a cry tore back his lips. He skidded to a knee, then pitched forward onto outstretched palms. He felt the cold sand shaking with the vibration of the roaring flame. He pushed himself up, desperately, palms shook, flaking sand, and started running again. Fleeing, he glanced back across his shoulder and saw that the spider was gaining on him, its pulsing egg of a body perched on running legs,
an egg whose yolk swam with killing poisons. He raced on, breathless terror in his veins. Suddenly the cliff edge was before him, shearing off abruptly to a gray perpendicular face. He raced along the edge, not looking down into the vast canyon below. The giant spider scuttled after him, the sound of its running a delicate scraping on the stone. It was closer still. The man dashed between two giant cans that loomed like tanks above him. He threaded, racing in between the silent bulks of all the clustered cans, past green and red and yellow sides, all caked with livid smears. The spider had to climb above them, unable to move its swollen body rapidly enough between them. It slithered up the side of one, then sped across their metal tops, bridging the gaps between them with sudden, jerking hops. As the man started out into the open again, he heard a scratching sound above. Recoiling and jerking back his head, he saw the spider just about to leap on him, two legs slipping down the metal side, the rest clutching at the top. With a terrified gasp, the man dived again into the space between the giant cans, half running, half stumbling back along the winding route. Behind him, the spider drew itself back up to the top and, backing around in a twitching semicircle, started after him again. The move gained seconds for the man. Plunging out into the shadow-swept sands again, he raced around the great stone pillar and through another stack of tank-like structures. The spider leaped down on the sand and scurried in pursuit. The great orange mass loomed over the man now as he headed once more for the edges of the cliff. There was no time for hesitation. With an extra springing of his legs, he flung himself across the gulf and clutched with spastic fingers at the roughened ledge. Wincing, he drew himself onto the splintered orange surface just as the spider reached the cliff's edge. Jumping up, the man began running along the narrow ledge, not looking back. If the spider jumped that gap, it was over. The spider did not jump it. Glancing back, the man saw that and, stopping, stood there looking at the spider. Was he safe now that he was out of the spider's territory? His pale cheek twitched as he saw thread, twine, cable pour like shimmering vapor from the spider's tubes. Twisting around, he began running again, knowing that as soon as the cable was long enough, air currents would lift it. It would cling to the orange ledge, and the black spider would clamber up it. He tried to run faster, but he couldn't. His legs ached. Breath was a hot burning in his throat. A stitched throat, dagger points into his side. He ran and skidded down the orange slope, jumping the gaps with desperate, weakening lunges. Another edge, the man knelt quickly, tremblingly, and, holding tight, let himself over. It was a long drop to the next level. The man waited until his body was swinging inward, then let go. Just before he fell, he saw the great spider scrabbling down the orange slope at him. He landed on his feet and toppled forward on the hard wood. Pain drove needles up his right ankle. He struggled to his feet. He couldn't stop. Overhead, he heard the spider scratching. Running to the edge, he hesitated, then jumped into space again. The arm-thick curve of the metal wicket flashed up at him. He grabbed for it. He fell with a fluttering of arms and legs. The canyon floor rushed up at him. He had to miss the flower-patched softness. And yet he didn't. Almost at the edge of it, he landed feet first and bounced over backward in a neck-snapping somersault. He lay on his stomach and chest, breathing in short, strangled bursts. There was a smell of dusty cloth in his nostrils, and fabric was rough against his cheek. Alertness returned then, and with a spasmodic wrenching of muscles, the man looked up and saw another ghost-like cable being spun into the air. In a few minutes, he knew the spider would ride it down. Pushing up with a groan, he stood a moment on trembling legs. The ankle still hurt. Breathing was a strain, but there were no broken bones. He started off, hobbling quickly across the flower-splotched surface. The man lowered himself across the edge. As he did so, he saw the spider swinging down, a terrible, wriggling pendulum. He was on the floor of the canyon now. He ran limping across the wide plain of it, his sandals flopping on the leveled hardness. To his right loomed the vast brown tower in which the flame still burned, the very canyon trembling with its roar. He glanced behind. The spider was dropping to the flower-covered softness now, then rushing for the edge. The man raced on toward the great log pile, which was half as high as the tower itself. He ran by what looked like a giant coiled serpent, red and still and open-jawed at either end. The spider hit the canyon floor and ran at the man, but the man had reached the gigantic logs now, and falling forward on his chest, he wriggled into a narrow space between two of them. It was so narrow he could hardly move, dark, damp, cold, and smelling of moldy wood. He crawled and twisted in as far as he could, then stopped and looked back. The black, shiny-cased spider was trying to follow him. For a horrible moment, the man thought it was succeeding. Then he saw that it was stuck and had to pull back. It could not follow. Closing his eyes, the man lay there on the canyon floor, feeling the chill of it through his clothes, panting through his open mouth, wondering how many more times he would have to flee the spider. The flame in the steel tower went out then, and there was silence except for the spider scratching at the rock floor as it moved about restlessly. He could hear it scraping on the logs as it clambered over them, searching for a way to get at him. When at last the scratching sounds had gone, the man backed himself cautiously out from the narrow splintered edge passage between the logs. Out on the floor again, he stood with wary haste and looked in all directions to see where the spider was. High up on the sheer wall, he saw it climbing toward the cliff edge, its dark legs drawing its great egg of a body up the perpendicular face. A shaking breath trembled from the man's nostrils. He was safe for another while. Lowering his gaze, he started toward his sleeping place. He limped slowly past the silent steel tower, which was an oil burner, past the huge red serpent, which was a nozzleless garden hose, clumsily coiled on the floor, past the wide cushion whose case was covered with flower designs, past the immense orange structure, which was a stack of two wooden lawn chairs, past the great croquet mallets hanging in their racks. One of the wickets from the croquet set had been stuck in a groove on the top lawn chair. It was what the man in his flight had grabbed for and missed, and the tank-like cans were used to paint. Cans, and the spider was a black widow. He lived in a cellar. Now he walked past a towering closed tree toward his sleeping place, which was underneath a water heater. Just before he reached it, he twitched sharply as, in its concrete cave, the water pump lurched into spinning motion. He listened to its labored wheezing and sighing, which sounded like the breathing of a dying dragon. Then he clambered up the cement block on which the looming enamel-faced heater rested and crawled under its protective warmth. For a long time motionless, he lay on his bed, which was a rectangular sponge around which a torn handkerchief was wrapped. His chest rose and fell with shallow movements. His hands lay limp and curled at his sides. Without blinking, he stared up at the rust-caked bottom of the heater. So, that's a little bit like the so-called Shelob story from Americana. I included the New Year's Eve story because it's almost a sequel to the Eros Tree. The Eros Tree was included because it at least had something to do with spiders. And the bundle was thrown in just because it's a hell of a story. Weird as hell, anyway. As for Zimzam shopping, that's also kind of weird as hell. That it seems to me that the two of those stories, as mentioned, had to do with having an ulcer. I was like having like really bad nightmares during the period of that ulcer. For some reason, Beati seems to have exceptionally bad dreams around Thanksgiving, too, which was
where the little editorial preface to the bundle came in. As for the bundle, I don't understand the ending of it. I understand everything right up to the end. It must have made sense at the time, but part of, I think, what it means is that it didn't make sense. You know, it wasn't supposed to. In a dream, it doesn't make sense. You start screaming when something strikes you as being horrible enough to make you scream. And that was it. These dreams, well, you know, they're pretty obvious. Some are sex dreams, some are dreams about food. Some are extremely violent, like the Zim Zam shopping and the bundle. But, you know, they're like messages from the subconscious. I have to do another spider tape. Maybe do that story, Bizarre. This Matheson book was a major influence on me, and it probably influenced such things as the dream I was talking about. And there's a scene I'm looking at right now from the Arena's painting where somebody, like a kind of tiny St. George figure, is killing a Black Widow spider with a sword. The Shrinking Man was one of the great paranoid novels of the 50s. And one of the great science fiction novels of the period. Certainly one of the great horror novels of the period. And when it was translated to film, it was even good. So, that and the book I Am Legend would put Matheson among the greats. By the way, both of those books, both of those novels were favorites of mine when I was before I was in high school. Or they were favorites of Beatty's or whatever. This spider tape is dedicated to the spider on the Goblin Hood mask. And it's hoped that it'll help me as I try to paint the spiders into the panel of the triptych entitled The Spiders of Sodom. So, I don't, you know, maybe the sexual content.